Les colloques du Collège de France.
Well, now, so this was the perspective on psychiatric epidemiology from a long end, and we'll end with a perspective on social epidemiology from by Lisa Bergman, who is Thomas Cabot Professor of Public Policy and Epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health. She was previously director of the Harvard Center of Population and Development Studies and chair of the Department of Society, Human Development and Health at Harvard. She's an internationally recognized social epidemiologist whose work focuses extensively on social and policy influences on health outcomes, with research trying to understand inequalities in health related to socioeconomic status, different racial and ethnic groups, social networks, support, and isolation. And she has conducted this work both in the United States and internationally. So thank you very much, Lisa,
thank
for being
you.
Here.
Thank you. Well, it's an enormous pleasure to be here. It is very late in the day, I know. So I think what I want to do is start with my bottom line and work backwards. So one of the things Maria was like so gracious to start with the book. On social epidemiology, which was done in 2014. One of the things that I think of today is that it was so inspiring. I want to say that of all the aspirations that we could have had for what the next 10 years would look like, the presentations today were amazing and really inspiring. So let me say why, because I think it will lead into the talk. One is that the majority of them, not all of them, but the majority were based on interventions, either natural experiments and policy interventions, or actually randomized controlled trials. This advances the field enormously for one reason that has to do with causality that Eric had talked about, but the other reason is that it actually improves public health. It actually has a chance of improving the outcome. And that is enormous, and it's something that we aspired to, I think, 10 years ago, and there was the limited, their data that was available was really limited. The second reason that I think the Denmark study showed and several others, and I think David, your work in UK, is that it is truly population-based. Like we have moved from sort of smaller cohort studies of small areas to really being able to say something on the level of countries or you know, areas within countries, or very large groups of people who have suffered and are really vulnerable. And that is also really enormously valuable. So from the perspective of today, a huge success. You really, the selection of everybody was amazing. The thing that struck in my mind that's going to relate to the talk that I want to touch on is talking about etiologic periods. So when you're doing an observational study, you get these associations, even when they're really strong, you still rarely have an idea when the etiologic period was of interest. You don't know whether it was early childhood or middle or adulthood. You don't know when people learned parenting skills. And, you know, in some ways, it doesn't matter that much because you have this association. But when you decide you're going to change something, then it's very important that you get the etiologic period right. Because if it's too late or too early, you fail. And observational studies almost always obscure that. The other thing about etiologic periods that I will attribute to Maria Gleemore, who says to me, Lisa, there are two etiologic periods when you change something. There's the etiologic period for the disease, you know, where along the spectrum of disease development things have worked and you have to get the intervention right when it's at a point when you can actually change the disease outcome. But almost nothing is known about what we do about the etiologic period of the exposure. You want to change poverty, you want to change social networks, you want to change any environmental exposure. We have almost no idea what the etiologic period is. When we'll be able to do that change? And if that period fails, then you failed. So the hard part of doing these experiments with a causal inference and with really a genuine hope to improve things is that you have to get both of them right. And we really know very little about that. So with that, I'm going to start, and actually I'm going to even go back to Durkheim, since this seems to be a common theme. But I want actually, if there's one thing that you took away, that I took away today, and that I have been struggling with, it's this idea of, like, when do you intervene when it's effective? And you almost never think about the exposure side of that. You think a lot, you're sort of taught in epidemiology to think about the outcome side of the etiologic period. So let's see if I can change. Okay, so here's suicide, which I think has been shown maybe the majority of times, but I actually want to read it to you, in part because it's very beautiful. I apologize for it not being in French. I thought last night, oh, I should try to translate this book back again, but I know it would be twice as long. So, individuals making up a society change from year to year, yet the number of suicides itself does not change. The population of Paris renews itself very rapidly, yet the share of Paris in the total number of French suicides remains practically the same. The causes which thus fit the contingent of voluntary deaths for a given society or one part of it must then be independent of individuals, since they retain the same intensity no matter what particular person they operate on. And this is, I think, the most important kind of contribution. And then he goes on to say that the group thinks, feels, and acts entirely differently from the way its members would if they were isolated. If therefore we begin by studying these members separately, we will understand nothing about what is taking place in the group. So suicide varies inversely with the degree of integration of social groups of which the individual forms a part. And what I really want to say, and it's interesting because I don't fundamentally study mental health, but suicide is here the most important of all psychological outcomes, probably. And Durkheim challenges himself to understand how something that we think of as so intimate, so painful, so personal, so individual, that how could this be socially patterned? And there you have it. So it's not to say there aren't genetic factors, there aren't other factors that make you commit suicide or get heart disease or come down with breast cancer, but the social patterning of this is what's really important to observe. And so Durkheim then goes on to talk about two forms, which I think are both important. One is attachment, that we are all attached to each other, and I'm going to talk about networks. But the other reason is that integration also is a form of regulation. It's held in the fabric of society by norms and values. It's one of the reasons he said Catholics commit suicide less than Protestants, and people who are married commit suicide less than people who are divorced, etc. So these are really fundamental and have guided so much of my work that I just thought it's worth, I'm here in Paris. I'm going to talk about Durkheim for a minute. So I want to show you a model of a social network. And again, this is important because it starts with the person as an individual, but often we think of networks as only the personal, very intimate kind of relationships. And Jeremy Boissevin, who is an anthropologist, working in the 1970s, developed this model of a social network. And you'll notice some important things about it. One, it does not mention the relationship of the individual, whether it's kin or non-kin, married, not married. It talks about a personal cell, intimate cells, and then affective, nominal, and extended zones. And part of what I will talk about is the importance of these extended zones. So there's been a lot in network sociology about the strength of weak ties. People find jobs through weak ties. They get their cars fixed through weak ties. They find healthcare through weak ties. It turns out that the people who you know best have only access to the same information you have. So you don't actually find out much new information unless you have some extended ties. Friends of Friends was the title of the book. So this is the model. And then this is the framework, which I think is an important framework. It's one that's always in evolution. I change it every time I look at it. I want to say that I think it's interesting because over time I have evolved to believe much more that the social structural conditions, these macro social forces, actually guide the formation and functions of social networks. So in fact, social networks become kind of almost a mediating, like one of the reasons these macro social forces are so powerful and show the patterns they do are because of the network activation and functions that they do, and that those then lead to these functional outcomes of networks. So the functional outcomes of networks are things like social support. I actually put social capital in this area because I think it's a resource that flows through a network. A network is a social structural phenomenon. Its size, its density, it's who's in it, who you know. And those lead to pathways. Now, ultimately, it'd be wonderful to know all of that. I don't know of the study yet that does all of that. So it's up to us, I think, to take a piece at a time. And sometimes, if you're lucky, you get three or four of those pieces. You hardly ever get the whole thing. I want to say also that I really think that political and institutional policies are very important, and you've heard that today. That actually is new in the model compared to the last time where we hardly mentioned it. And these macro-social forces certainly work through other mechanisms besides social networks. Like this model started out as a way to explain how social networks work. You could look at material deprivation this way, or just poverty or economic. You could redo this model. I think the point is when you think about it, that you want to be explicit in your both theorizing and empirical analysis, which you're choosing, and to see how far you can go down the path. So today the roadmap is rather than just talk about social networks and population health, which I'll show you like just a few slides, I'm very interested in looking at these larger social conditions. Also to give you some hope, even in the United States, for which there's not a lot of hope these days, there are things on in Congress to establish a national strategy for social connections. And it's very interesting to see. There are ones in the UK, they tend to be more individual about loneliness and that sort of thing. But there is on the floor a push to establish a bill that would have an executive office to combat loneliness and strengthen communities, to require a national strategy on social connection, to improve public education and awareness, and support continuing research. Now, part of this is by Senator Murphy, is also a goal of improving democracy, right? It has as a goal civic engagement and having everybody much more connected and engaged. But it seems like a very important area. So I'll show you a few slides just to get it down in terms of mortality rates. And part of this I want to say is my story. It's sort of like, how did I move along thinking about what's important from one thing to the next? So this was the first study that we did on social isolation in Alameda County. And you see the bars for men and women, and people who had low social networks had very much elevated mortality rates over this 8-year period. They were, in fact, 1.8 times more likely to die in the 9-year period. And this looked at both their intimate marital relationships, their close friends and family, and their extended kind of voluntary and civic engagement. And there was a lot of substitution. There was not one thing. So if you were divorced, but you had a lot of friends and family, you had an equal risk. If you belonged to religious organizations, but no voluntary ones, it was the same as somebody who belonged to voluntary ones and no religious ones. So there's a lot of substitutability and exchangeability in these ties. The point is you have to have some all the way along. This is a Gallup World Poll that just looks at the odds of better self-reported health by social support across the entire world. It's many, many countries, I think 100 and something, 180 maybe or something. Those with social support have 1.7 to 2.2 times the odds of better self-reported health across all religions, across all regions during this time. So you see that this is a quite global phenomena. What is different, I would say, is that the distribution of social isolation is different. So the difference in the distribution of risk is different. The relative risk is about the same in different countries. But France has a prevalence of like 4 or 5% of social isolation compared to the United States. The last time we looked, that's like 10 or 12. Also, one of the things that's really interesting is that social integration predicts the preservation of memory in the US. This is a study from the Health and Retirement Study, and it shows that over time, people who have high levels of social integration, which is very similar to the earlier scale, have better retention of memory scores. The thing that's interesting about this and why it's interesting to be explicit in the model earlier is that the evidence now is more, leans more heavily towards the fact that social engagement is important, not social support for memory. So if you look at some countries where people, I always use Japan as an obligation, like you have to be part of the family. You have to fix dinner, you have to set the table, you have to take care of children, you have to do something. It's not what you get, it's kind of how engaged you are. That seems to be the more important factor for risk of dementia. And support is what happens after you start to decline. So it's very important in this causal pathway. As people decline, they need more support. But if you look at what looks like it's predicting, it's actually this higher level of integration and support. So now I want to go to social and structural conditions. And I just want to give one example here. You could have done anything. One could have done anything. I'm particularly interested in labor and work policies and their effect, especially work-family labor policies. So it aligns quite well with work that Emily is doing and others here. And many of you talked about work-family. So I'm going to show you some of that. And I also am interested in work because, at least in the United States, it is among the more modifiable characteristics. My theory is that people who are in even private organizations change how work is organized all the time. They change labor policies, they change precarity, they change hours. They do it mostly so they're more productive, but they could also do it for improving worker health and worker and family health, but they tend to think that way. So I think of work as something of all the macro forces that we could change. Work may be one of the more modifiable kinds of conditions. So I want to show you one observational study that looks at the breaking point. It's a study that I did with several other colleagues. Erica Sabbath was the first in this, and it's on work stress, motherhood, marital status as risk factors for mortality among working US women. And in this study, we looked at people who were married mothers, who were later single mothers, who were early single mothers earlier in their life, who were long-term married, later married, and we looked at their job control measures. Now, I want to say that job control is very important for everybody. So if you even look at the control, the average married mother on the top, you see that the high control is the reference. Low job control is 1.3. So low job control is important always. But when you start to look at the cumulative mortality risks, if you look, for instance, that isn't pointing. Whoops. Well, if you look at low job controls among later single mothers, you see that the risk is 1.9. You look at earlier single moms, the risks are 1.7 and 1.6. And long-term married mothers have just slightly elevated risks compared to the control. the really optimal group, which may meet many women's criteria here, is that you get married later, you have kids later, and you're in a high control job. That turns out to be probably the best. I wouldn't put all my money on it, but I definitely fall in that category. So overall here is when job strain is coupled with family composition, having young children or being a single parent, mortality risks are increased. So when you get this job strain and no control over your job hours, coupled with being a single mom, you really have an at-risk situation that makes you more vulnerable. So the next question we ask is, can we modify work characteristics and improve health? Okay, so this is a study that now moves into the policy realm and also really looks at this. I'm going to show you first a randomized policy experiment and then another RCT that we did. Can you change, modify work characteristics and improve health? And actually, Emily had talked about it a little bit, and it's a study that Wurzio was first author of, and it's on maternity leave policy and health at older ages, and it's data from SHARE. So these are the maternity leave policies by country between 1965 and 2010. These are full wage weeks. We exclude Sweden because it would go bounce off the ceiling for these policies. And what you have is a very ideal experiment for a policy experiment that has changed among countries and changed over time. To do this, and just to be clear about the outcome without showing you a lot of the data, so using data from women in these countries from SHARE and employing a diff and diff method, we found 16.2% difference in depression score at older ages. These are people who are over 50, between women living in high versus low maternity benefit countries. So in this case, women had to get full wage, a number of full wage weeks for a certain time, and it is really an intent to treat. It's just living in the country where there was this policy. And more generous maternity benefits during birth of a child resulted in fewer depressive symptoms at way older ages. Now, one of the mysteries of this, and it points to something that actually Eric had pointed out, is that here we have a policy, we have very little window into what it is that happened, right? We don't know what giving women that policy or exposing them to the opportunity of that policy actually did. But one of the things as you start to read about maternal and paternity leave or family leave in general is that the obvious thing is that it definitely gives you more time with your family, whether it's your child or your spouse or other family members. So it's almost by nature a social network, kind of a social support intervention. However, honestly, we don't know. So one of the areas for people to be working in is like, this is just a window, right? It's with nothing in between for us to understand. It would be great if we could fill in more of those boxes. Here's another study that Jennifer Glass led, who's a sociologist, and she looked at parenthood and happiness, the effects of work-family reconciliation policies in 22, sorry if that's an OECD, countries. And you'll be happy, if you're French, that being there. This is looking at whether you're happier being a parent or not being a parent. And so in some countries, people who are parents are happier, and in other countries, being a non-parent makes you happier. So France is one of the countries where you are happier if you are a parent than a non-parent. You'll see where the United States and the UK are in this list. It's a sad commentary on this, but very interesting. And here, this is looking at a comprehensive policy index that they created that includes a lot of pro-family policies, including like childcare, parental leave, some resources, that sort of thing. What's really interesting about this is in low comprehensive policy countries, being a non-parent makes you happier than being a parent. In high comprehensive policy countries, everybody's happier, whether you're a parent or a non-parent. Like, those are good policies, right? They turn out to be good policies probably for everybody. And there's no difference between being, you pay no penalty for being a parent in these countries. So now I want to turn to a study that I spent probably 10 years of my life on, doing a randomized control trial to see whether if you changed into companies, work family organization, by giving workers more voice, more control over work, letting them decide some practices, could you actually change a very large number of health outcomes that we were interested in? And this study had a lot of people in it. It was a lot of sites involved. However, it was two industries. And one industry was an IT industry, and it was led by a group of people at Minnesota, Aaron Kelly. And the other industry was a long-term care setting, which we worked with, and it was based in Boston. However, the companies were large regional country industries. They weren't national. They didn't spread the whole country, but they actually spread large regions and were large numbers. So in this study, I want to say, first of all, the randomization was at the level of the work site. Like, individuals were not randomized. Work sites were randomized. So in the long-term care industry, there were 30 work sites, nursing homes, essentially, that were randomized half to the intervention, half to the same. So the randomization was an organizational randomization. In the IT, it was actually one industry. It wasn't in a lot of sites. So units were randomized. But still, the point is the same. The organization was level at which change wanted to happen, we wanted change to happen, was that unit. So we trained supervisors. These are, in this case, like in the case of long-term care, there were mostly nurse managers who we trained to be more attuned to work-family balance and issues of equity. So I want to say our industry was a very working class, middle wage income area. They were nurses and nursing assistants, who are pretty low-wage workers, both hourly and monthly workers. So we were very attuned to issues of equity. We were also very attuned to the fact that managers, up until the time that we started, doled out work-family favors to their favorite workers. There was not a sense that this was an equity issue or a right or part of their worker compensation. It was very much like, oh, I really like you, you're a great worker. If you need to take care of your mother now, go ahead, take off for a week. So we trained supervisors, and in fact, we gave them an app to do to be equitable about giving people time off and letting them balance these issues. We also had employer and supervisor group team meetings to develop approaches to scheduling work, work practices, increasing worker voice. And overall, here are our findings. Overall, what happened was job satisfaction increased. This is among IT workers, sleep duration, sense of having enough time, schedule control, supervisor support, adolescent time that was spent with parents, adolescents' handling of everyday stressors was improved, and what got better was reduced, but good things, as burnout was reduced, stress was reduced, psychological distress was reduced, and I'll show you one about cardiometabolic after I show you there. The ones in long-term care actually were not as many and not as multiple. So one of the things I want to say is IT is a much looser organization. Nursing homes are highly regulated, highly, highly regulated. Number of people have to be on the floor. It was harder to change some of these things. However, the bottom line for this, and the one that I'm really very intrigued with, is that we looked at cardiometabolic risk, and we looked at it at 3, 6, and 12 months. They were all done by biomarkers. We took people's blood pressure. We used a Framingham kind of combined index. And what we found is that in the intervention group, They reduce their cardiometabolic risk on the order, if you look at aging, about 5 to 10 years. So everybody increases their risk over time. It seems inevitable, even though we can try to make it go slower. But the intervention group increased much more slowly. And the biggest effects, what you see here at the end, is that the biggest effects were for the people who had the most risk. The least change happened among people where you see non-significant white bars, for people who had limited risk. But some of those people are 30 or 40 years old, and there was very, you know, it's a floor effect, like you couldn't get better in those. But for people who are reaching a period of risk of 40 or 50, you really saw this change in risk over a period of a year that was related to a worksite intervention at this intention to treat level. So it gives me hope, actually, having done several social support and social network interventions which produce null results, that actually you can change, you can change workplaces, and you can get the period right, and you can change cardiometabolic risk at a period where it's likely to really influence their chance of cardiometabolic mortality. So overall, workplace practices in early and mid-adulthood are associated with the early development of cardiometabolic risk, and social networks and population health actually have hope, both from the perspective of us developing interventions, as well as thinking about the way in which social inequalities play out in our countries. So I will end here. Thanks.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.